It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. The subject for today is right intention. And the Sanskrit word for intention might also be translated as thought. And Dogen used thought. And he said, breaking your meditation pillow is what right thought is about. He also said, think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. This in itself is the essential art of Zazen. So this amazing statement of Dogen, that right thought is breaking your Zazen pillow, whose essential art is not thinking, accomplished by non-thinking. So right thought is non-thinking. So that's easy to remember. Right thought is non-thinking. The Buddha himself did not flesh out the factors of the path in his initial teaching. But while he was still a bodhisattva, he refers to two sorts of thought that he identified in himself: unwholesome thoughts, which he noticed obstructed his judgment and promoted vexation. And he noticed they were harmful and did not lead to liberation. But he noticed, when he noticed this, he noticed that such thoughts subsided. And when he indulged them, their, quote, habit force increased. And opposite to these were wholesome thoughts that did not lead to affliction. And when he turned toward them, their habit force increased, and the habit force of the corresponding unwholesome thoughts decreased. So thus he saw that the antidote to thoughts of desire or greed is renunciation, to ill will is loving kindness, and to cruelty, the antidote is compassion. I like the expression habit force, which so speaks to the power of stuff in our nervous systems that rule our lives and thwart our best intentions. But also this idea of turning to the opposite positive quality of whatever our current problematic habit force. He names three: desire, ill will, and cruelty. But in truth, when you find yourself unable to change a pattern that's not serving your life, cultivating its opposite positive quality with great intention is likely to help. And yet another word for intention is vow. It seems that we need to deeply vow to practice wholesome thought in order to let go of unwholesome thought. And Dogen wrote these words for arousing this vow of practice. And I find them extremely moving. This is Dogen now. We vow with all beings from this life on throughout countless lives to hear the true Dharma, that upon hearing it, no doubt will arise in us, nor will we lack in faith, that upon meeting it, we shall renounce worldly affairs and maintain the Buddha Dharma. Although our past evil karma has greatly accumulated, indeed, being the cause and condition of obstacles in practicing the way. That is that sentence right there. Our past evil karma, which has greatly accumulated, indeed being the cause and condition of obstacles in practicing the way. May all Buddhists and ancestors who have attained the Buddha way be compassionate to us and free us from karmic effects, allowing us to practice the way without hindrance. Quietly explore the farthest reaches of these causes and conditions. This is still Dogen. Quietly explore the farthest reaches of these causes and conditions, as this practice is the exact transmission of a verified Buddha. Confessing and repenting in this way, one never fails to receive profound help from all Buddhas and ancestors. By revealing and disclosing our lack of faith and practice before the Buddha, we melt away the root of transgressions by the power of our confession and repentance. This is the pure and simple color of true practice, of the true mind of faith, of the true body of faith. So in this moving declaration of his deep intention to practice, Dogen Zenji tells us to own our karmic formations and habits and to explore the causes and conditions that led to those hindrances. We are to, quote, confess and repent, that is to deeply own them and acknowledge the real harm that arises from our unwholesome habits of mind. We ask for help from our great Bodhisattva ancestors, and in the process, we melt away the very roots of our transgressions. And Dogen also explains that generosity is the first of the paramitas because it serves to initiate the process of changing the mind. And if you're unfamiliar, by the way, with paramitas, listen to the talk on generosity, the first paramita in my series, The Bodhisattva Way of Wisdom and Compassion. But on this subject, Dogen says, even when you give a particle of dust, you should rejoice in your own act because you authentically transmit the merit of all Buddhas and begin to practice an act of a bodhisattva. The mind of a, never forget this next sentence, the mind of a sentient being is difficult to change. The mind of a sentient being is difficult to change. Keep on changing the minds of sentient beings from the moment that you offer one valuable to the moment that they attain the way. This should be initiated by giving. Thus, giving is the first of the paramitas. And Dogen reminds us to include ourselves in the giving. He says, know that to give to yourself is a part of giving. But this idea that the mind of a sentient being is difficult to change, let's look at the antidotes to our obstacles to change that the Buddha suggests in more detail. So how do we practice renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion in the face of a strong pull in the opposite direction? So regarding renunciation, this is basically what the Buddha said that he does. We explore. We deeply explore the causes and conditions of our hindrances. We notice when desire arises. And sometimes we indulge in fantasies, we notice that, we do not judge. If we judge, we notice that. And beating up on ourselves is just another layer of desire. And aversion is another aspect of desire. So I am a bad, selfish, lustful, greedy person, and so on. I wish I were, da-da-da. That's how it works. I wish is the desire. So instead, over and over, we practice letting go of that story, confessing and repenting, disclosing our wrongdoings. And this process actually can become even more interesting than the wrongdoing if it's done wholeheartedly. This is the pure and simple color of pure practice, of true practice, of the true mind of faith, of the true body of faith, Dogen says. So that's renunciation. Explore, notice, do not judge, and keep on letting go of the story. And then regarding loving kindness, the classic text on loving kindness is found in The Path of Purification, which is an ancient compendium of the Buddha's teaching written in 412 CE. The most well-known section is called The Four Brahma Viharas, or Divine Abodes. You've probably heard of these: loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. They're called the four divine abodes. The initial practice is meditation on loving kindness, beginning with oneself. And the classic meditation on loving kindness begins with wishing oneself well, happy, at ease. And perhaps after first opening the heart by thinking of someone loved and in difficulty, open your heart. But the exercise begins with taking oneself into the heart. But as Martin Luther King Jr. said, in the final analysis, love is not this sentimental feeling. Not that that was sentimental, but he says, love is not this sentimental something we talk about. It's not merely an emotional something. Love is creative understanding, goodwill for all men. It is the refusal to defeat any individual. When you rise to the level of love, of its great beauty and power, you seek only to defeat evil systems. So these are powerful words. Martin Luther King Jr. admonishes us to follow them as practical advice. The more we know the harm from a habit force of ill will, the stronger our intention to develop the habit force of loving kindness, starting with ourselves and then spreading to all beings. Regarding compassion, Reb Anderson Roshi once gave a lecture on compassion, and he defined it as stay close and do nothing. We stay close when we tune into the connection with ourselves and others, so we know what's going on inside ourselves, whatever it is, anger, etc. And as we get to know our suffering, compassion naturally arises. And from there, it spreads to everyone else. And we can listen in and respond even in the silence of just knowing. So staying silent and doing nothing, by the way, keeps the focus on the other and not about I. We can develop right intention only by enacting it over and over, by putting our intention of paying attention to our unwholesome habits of mind and thus finding the motivation to let them go. As we acknowledge the harm from unwholesome habits of mind more and more deeply, wholesome habits naturally arise, and we can find the will to nurture renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion in our hearts and minds until they become the presiding habit force. And now I want to tell you two stories of right intention. And the first is the one of how it came about that women were included in the practice of monastics. Here, right intention is clear as a bell, as you'll see. The second one, I may have told you this, I may have read this before to you, but it's appropriate here. It's the one of me finding Zen and then beginning practice at Tassajara. And as you will see, this is a much murkier picture of right intention. But it's good to know. It's good to know right intention is, it's full of battles. I mean, you can have right intention, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intention. So all right, this first story is of Lady Gotami, who was basically the Buddha's mother, stepmother. But his mother from the time he was 8 days old. So it's pretty much mother. The story how women were finally allowed to practice as monastics began with Lady Gotami, Siddhartha's stepmother. She and Yasodhara, Siddhartha's wife, led a huge gathering of women with shaved heads and barefoot on a 15-day walk to the Buddha's monastery to show their strength, sincerity, and authentic desire for wisdom. And this is a wonderful story of right intention. And this version is from Thich Nhat Hanh, whose recent death we definitely mourn. Early one morning, on his way to the lake to get some water, Ananda met Gotami and 50 other women standing not far from the Buddha's hut. Every woman had shaved her head and was wearing a yellow robe. Their feet were swollen and bloody. At first glance, Ananda thought it was a delegation of monks, but suddenly he recognized Lady Gotama. Hardly able to believe his eyes, he blurted, "Good heavens, Lady Gotama! Gotami, excuse me. Where have you come from? Why are your feet so bloody? Why have you and all the ladies come here like this?" Gotami answered, "Venerable Ananda, we have shaved our heads and given away all our fine clothes and jewels. We no longer have any possessions in this world. We left Kapilavatthu and have walked for 15 days sleeping by the roadside and begging for food in small villages along the way. We wish to show that we are capable of living like bhikkhus. I beseech you, Ananda, please speak with the Buddha on our behalf. We wish to be ordained as nuns." Ananda said, "Wait here and I'll speak to the Buddha at once. I promise to do all I can." Ananda entered the Buddha's hut just as the Buddha was putting on his robe. Nagita, the Buddha's assistant at that time, was also present. Ananda told the Buddha all he had just seen and heard, and the Buddha did not say anything. Ananda then asked, "Lord, is it possible for a woman to attain the fruits of stream enterer, once returner, never returner, and arhatship?" Those are all steps along the way to enlightenment. The Buddha answered, "Beyond a doubt, then why don't you accept women into the Sangha? Lady Gotami nurtured and cared for you from the time you were an infant. She has loved you like a son. Now she has shaved her head and renounced all her possessions. She has walked all the way from Kapilavatthu to prove that women can endure anything that men can. Please have compassion and allow her to be ordained. The Buddha was silent for a long moment. Then he asked Nagita to summon the venerables Sariputta, Moggallana, Anuruddha, Bhadiya, Kimbila, and Mahakasyapa. When they arrived, he discussed the situation with them at length. He explained that it was not discrimination against women which made him hesitate to ordain them. He was unsure how to open the Sangha to women without creating harmful conflict both within and outside of the Sangha. After a lengthy exchange of ideas, Sariputta said, "It would be wise to create statutes which define the roles of nuns within the Sangha. Such statutes would diminish public opposition, which is certain to erupt, since there has been discrimination against women for thousands of years. Please consider the following 8 rules. First, a nun or bhikkhuni will always defer to a bhikkhu, even if she is older or has practiced longer than he has. Second, all bhikkhunis must spend the retreat season at a center within reach of a center of bhikkhus in order to receive spiritual support and further study. The retreat season is the rainy season, and it's about 3 months. Third, twice a month, the bhikkhuni should delegate someone to invite the bhikkhus to decide on a date for upasata, the special day of observance. A bhikkhu should visit the nuns, teach them, and encourage them in their practice. Fourth, after the rainy season retreat, nuns must attend the paravana ceremony and present an account of their practice, not only before other nuns, but before monks. Fifth, whenever a bhikkhuni breaks a precept, she must confess before both the bhikkhunis and the bhikkhus. Sixth, after a period of practice as a novice, a bhikkhuni will take full vows before the communities of both monks and nuns. Seventh, a bhikkhuni should not criticize or censor a bhikkhu. Eighth, a bhikkhuni will not give dharma instruction to a community of bhikkhus." Moggallana laughed. "These 8 rules are clearly discriminatory. How can you pretend otherwise?" And Sariputta replied, "The purpose of these rules is to open the door for women to join the Sangha. They are not intended to discriminate, but to help end discrimination. Don't you see?" Moggallana nodded, acknowledging the merit of Sariputta's statement. Bhadiya said, "These 8 rules are necessary. Lady Gotami today has commanded much authority. She is the Lord's mother. Without rules such as these, it would be difficult for anyone except the Buddha himself to guide her in her practice." The Buddha turned to Ananda. "Ananda, please go and tell Lady Mahaprajnapati," that's Lady Gotami, "that if she is will—" So basically he's already addressing her as ordained. "That if she is willing to accept these 8 special rules, she and the other women may be ordained. The sun had already climbed high into the sky, but Ananda found Lady Gotami and the other women patiently waiting. After hearing the eight rules, Gotami was overjoyed. She replied, "Venerable Ananda, please tell the Buddha that just as a young girl gladly accepts a garland of lotus flowers or roses to adorn her hair after washing it with perfumed water, I happily accept the eight rules. I will follow them all my life if I am granted permission to be ordained." Ananda returned to the Buddha's hut and informed him of Lady Gotami's response. The other women looked at Gotami with concern in their eyes, but she smiled and reassured them, "Don't worry, my sisters. The important thing is that we have earned the right to be ordained. These eight rules will not be barriers to our practice. They are the door by which we may enter the Sangha." And all 51 of the women were ordained that day. Venerable Shariputra arranged for them to live temporarily at Ambapali's mango grove. The Buddha also asked Shariputra to teach the nuns the basic practice. The story of how women were allowed to practice as monastics, especially in this beyond discriminatory time, I find extremely moving. Their intention in the face of enormous obstacles is a wonderful and inspiring example for all of us. And talk about right intention. Like I said, it's clear as a bell. So now we turn to, and forgive me if I've already read this, I think I have, two short passages from my memoir, Moon of the Swaying Buds, that show the complexity and ultimately battle of right intention. Right intention is there, but it is soaked in selfishness, small view, ingratitude, and other unflattering impulses that, were it not for the fact that I was there in the first place, right intention would all but disappear. So these sections are entitled Monotony, Both Lugubrious and Strangely Crisp. That's the first one. And Dark Wet Mud is the second one. And each brief passage of prose is followed by a commentary in haiku. So this is Monotony, Both Lugubrious and Strangely Crisp. The first moment I enter a zendo, it feels right. I have hardly heard of zazen, but as the sun rises and I chant the robe chant, this gesture feels correct. The same sense, almost a nostalgia, comes over me at Teisho. Katagiri Sensei's words grab my being as if gently shaking and then opening them. This is real. This is so. And while the effort Zen practice requires seems almost beyond my capabilities, the freshness, the certainty of inner knowing compels me again and again to greet the dawn with a straight back. And little haiku, home at last, I sleep numbed by rain. The room is dark and fragrant. People are getting settled, plumping their cushions and swaying back and forth. Seated along a far wall, I quickly become absorbed in the vibration of bells and silence reverberating into one another. And the haiku, one plum falls, a warbler screech in the distance. Meals finally bring warmth, It is clear food, straightforward food I respect. Then more sitting, a lecture, tea with a surprise sweet. I find the rhythm akin to me, the monotony, both lugubrious and strangely crisp, washes over my being. Very familiar. And the haiku. Moonrise, a silhouette drifts along the inlet. Still, I can't adjust, get comfortable, find the right posture. The day takes forever. Its elegance, which describes a frank and beautiful way to be, becomes an injunction by sheer force of its multi-leveled presence. I find myself acquiescing, agreeing almost as an aesthetic response, but I am cold and scared. Actually, the Buddha, the Tathagata, often appeals to this bony migrant aspect of his disciples. And the haiku. A shorebird cries across the dunes, the hollow rattle of wind. And then the second one, this is about Tassajara, and this is the one, Dark Wet Mud. People sleep, all but a Doan who lights the lanterns and then stomps through camp, ringing the wake-up bell at 3:20 precisely. Thump, thump, thump. The fact that the bell is handheld, hand-rung, a human being is running swiftly, steadily, softens the effect of its clangorous sound. Suzuki Roshi says, when the wake-up bell rings, get up. Never make a decision twice. I snuggle more deeply into my sleeping bag. And the haiku, silence, but for buntings twittering in the sedge. The effort that it takes to get up, wash, dress, walk through the rain to the zendo seems out of proportion to the accomplishment. Lonely, tired, cold, knowing exactly why I do this. I wonder why I do this. And the haiku, kerplunk, scurrying through the grass, then plopping in the water. Monastic life has been known to me forever. I am back now, and the simultaneous feelings of freshness and familiarity pass over me in waves. Home at last, not a single leaf on the crooked tree. I am given a room with two, quote, older students in the barn. Indeed, with their altars, scrolls, and vases of flowers, they seem delightfully snug. I have no possessions. This is an appealing concept and represents a shift for me, but I can't relax. And the haiku, no ducks, no geese, just snow on the frozen lake. My drab corner mortifies me. I have nothing to soften its impersonal coarseness. So I end up with no place of refuge, no solacing activity. Before I arrived, I had my rocking chair, my books, my harpsichord. I had food I chose myself. I had a companion. I had the presiding thought of devoting my life to music and literature. Now I have the stricture, everything I own, I carry in my backpack. And the haiku, traipsing in my gaitas down the rain-drenched path, a single squawk through the darkening, morning air. The barn is at the outer limits of the monastery grounds. It bothers me that I have to walk so far in my unsteady shoes, on the unsteady path, sometimes in the rain, often in the dark. People who live in the dorm, I think, get to hop next door, whereas I have to trudge my way gropingly, clumsily, allowing an extra 15 minutes. I see this as significant. It falls to me to work harder, to have to get up earlier, to arrive with my shoes caked with mud or soaked with rain, and to have all this unacknowledged. And the haiku. Afterwards, what's left of her tears? Dark, wet mud. So here are some of the most important points from today's talk. First, the Dogen used the word thought instead of intention. He said, breaking your meditation pillow is what right thought is about. So basically that's saying, breaking your meditation pillow is what right intention is about. He also said, think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. This in itself is the essential art of Zazen. Second, the Buddha saw that the antidote to thoughts of desire or greed is renunciation. To ill will, loving kindness, and to cruelty, the antidote is compassion. And the gist of that, as I've said, is the opposite positive quality. Third, in order to change our habits of mind, we must practice generosity with ourselves as well as others. And don't forget that human beings have a difficult time changing their habits of mind. So we have to practice generosity with ourselves as well as others. Fourth, Reb Anderson Roshi defined compassion as stay close and do nothing. Stay close and do nothing. And fifth, Martin Luther King Jr.'s words, love is creative, understanding goodwill for all men. It is the refusal to defeat any individual. And lastly, Dogen's words, quietly explore the farthest reaches of the causes and conditions of our negative habit forces, as this practice is the exact transmission of a verified Buddha. In other words, that's what Buddhas do. They quietly explore the farthest reaches of the causes and conditions of their negative habit forces. So confessing and repenting in this way, one never fails to receive profound help from all Buddhas and ancestors. And regarding points for reflection, during the week, first, Dogen's stirring words on arousing the vow of practice. So what did they do for you and were they stirring to you? And might you use them to make your own vow of practice? Maybe they weren't stirring to you. And so to think about that and say why. And second, What were your thoughts as you heard the story of Lady Gotami shaving her head, giving away her possessions, and walking barefoot for 15 days to appeal to the Buddha for entrance into his monastery? And all this as his mother, actually. So third, what were your thoughts about the 8 rules the first women monastics had to agree to? And do you agree with Lady Gotami's assessment that they weren't discriminatory, they were a door, and that they were actually against discrimination? Fourth, could you relate to the 2 passages from my memoir about starting practice and then monastic practice? Did they have what effect did they have on your right intention? Because that was just a huge example of wrong intention. And fifth, well, not of wrong intention, but just kind of wrong view. It was just wrong attitude. Okay, fifth. What are your intentions and what are your intentions in terms of Buddhist practice? And on this one, try to be really clear, spell them out. Your intentions for Buddhist practice, spell them out. Spell out your obstacles while you're at it also. And can you name the causes and conditions and then the deeper causes and conditions of these obstacles? So really think about, what are your intentions regarding Buddhist practice? What are the obstacles? And what are the causes and conditions and deeper causes and conditions of the obstacles? I wonder if there are questions.
Thank you, Gail. So this one is about you. When you were in Dasahara, it does seem like it was hard. Why didn't you just leave?
Willpower. The practice period was 3 months and I was too ashamed to leave. And remember last week when we talked about right view, one moves from a mind of complaint to a mind of gratitude. And the mind of gratitude, by the way, is right view. That is right view right there, the mind of gratitude. But from my complete lack of gratitude, you can see wrong view. And from wrong view, nothing good is gonna come from wrong view. So instead of seeing what an incredible opportunity I had, just first to be at such a place and second, that such a place even existed, everything was too much trouble for me. And I'm really sorry to say that I think this was the low point of all of it. During the forest fires, and fires were raging around the mountains of the valley where Dasahara is, I actually had the thought that if Dasahara burns down, then I don't have to be here. So you ask, why didn't I just leave? You know, well, I'd rather Dasahara burn down and then I wouldn't have to be there. So wrong view leads to wrong view. And the opposite is also true. Right view, gratitude, and also the awareness of the interconnectedness of all beings leads to gratitude, compassion, and an overwhelmingly open heart. And if you don't have that feeling, by the way, for this practice, then you may not be integrating what you know about Buddhism with your whole body and everyday life. Zen is not a head practice. It's a heart-body practice. But thank you for asking. It is an important question. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So the next one that we got is, can you give an example of a cause and condition for a typical obstacle to practice?
Yes. A cause and condition can be, I just had two of them, so that's why I'm. A cause and condition can be sometimes there's something called a life that you have to rest. You've worked so hard in many lifetimes that you spend a whole lifetime just resting. And that lifetime of resting can be a cause and condition of everything is too much trouble, like I was having. There are other causes and conditions of everything is too much trouble, but that's a cause and condition. So the reason that I think it's Dogen who says we need to look at our causes and conditions and also the deeper causes and conditions. When he says deeper causes and conditions, I think he means things, causes and conditions that we sense we came with us into this lifetime. I know I can sense them. There are behaviors of mine that don't make any sense from just this lifetime. And they only make sense when I think of past lifetimes. So those kind of things can be deeper causes and conditions for wrong views, put it today in this lifetime. Let's see, though, there can be shallower ones, though, shallower causes and conditions. A lot of times when we behave in a certain way, that behavior comes right back to us. So if we're ungenerous or inconsiderate or, you know, just not thinking of people, others altogether, that will come right back to us. And then if we decide to get on the path, we have to deal with that. So that's enough. I think you get the idea. Thank you.
So Gail, the next question that we have is, Dogen sees obstacles on the path to liberation as a karmic consequence of past bad habit behavior. I feel intuitively that this is so and that I have a lot of it. So much that serious practice almost seems beyond me. Is willpower really the answer?
No, 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 no. It definitely is not the answer. But look at what Dogen advises. Quietly explore the farthest reaches of these causes and conditions. Confessing and repenting and you never fail. And if you confess and repent, you never fail to receive the profound help from all Buddha ancestors, Buddhas and ancestors. And by doing this, you melt away the root of the transgressions by the power of your confession and repentance. So exploring the causes and conditions and confessing and repenting what you've seen or your wrongdoings. And then that in itself melts away the power of the wrongdoings the power to be obstacles in your path. In Buddhist practice centers, usually on the full moon and even the half moon days, there are community confession ceremonies. And so like twice a month, there are regular confession ceremonies in Buddhist practice centers. So just to know that this is done in front of everyone regularly. And so for us to make our own. So instead of willpower, you can do explore and confess and repent. Thank you.
So the next question that we have is, I wasn't prepared for the connection Dogen made between giving and helping people change their habit forces and by giving to yourself first. Dogen often makes these unexpected connections.
I know. He does that all the time. But generosity is powerful. And it's forever. And it reminds me of when Dogen said that we were still feeling the effects. Remember, this was from last week. We are still feeling the effects of Siddhartha's 6 years of upright sitting. That's when he was practicing with the five ascetics. And you can think of Zazen, by the way, as fundamentally generous at its root. Generosity is at the root of Zazen. And by the way, Zazen is one of the best ways of loosening habit forces. So I wasn't prepared for it either. I was surprised when I saw that Dogen made this connection. But he does it all the time. As we'll, if you don't already know, you'll get to know. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So the next question that we just got is, your observations about bells at 3:30 and walking through the rain would have been felt by man and a woman alike. At the beginning, were you feeling obstacles specific to being a woman?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't feeling, and my roommates that were so cozy, they were both women. This was just me. I was not being discriminated against at all. Actually, from a different point of view, you could have seen that barn as a kind of a way of being a little bit off the beaten path and a relief in a sense. And in fact, there was the barn, there were rooms in the barn. And then on the room I was assigned, there was a back porch, and the back porch was right over Tassajara Creek, which was gurgling furiously the entire time. And I got really sick actually that summer. And I think I slept for a whole week. I was exhausted and I was sick. And my room, I set up my sleeping mat on that porch right over Tassajara Creek. And there were like gorgeous trees, you know, overlapping my porch. So, I mean, I had this porch with these gorgeous trees and a gurgling creek. You could look at, I mean, I was like in a palace, I mean, in a certain way, because it was hot. It was something, you know, summer, it was very hot. So I might have had the spot in all of Tassajara. That's another way to look at it, you know, but I didn't. I saw it as, all I did was complain. So I didn't complain outside. So inside, I was full of complaints and I had almost no gratitude. And my only saving grace, honestly, from that time was somehow I got myself there. Well, I didn't know. I mean, I got there, but I had no idea what there was. And it was way too much for me. The truth is, I mean, today, I would never, you have to sit Tangaryo before you can practice a Tassajara. Tangaryo is 5 days of all day sitting every single day. I had only been practicing for 6 months. It was just way, way, way too soon. But no one, if things were just getting started at that time, no one really knew anything. And so no one, you know, no one questioned my going. And it was a mistake in the first place, but nobody else handled it as badly as I did. No one was complaining like I was. And so it was me. I'm sorry to say. I wish I didn't have to say that. But I see we're out of time. And I don't want the time to pass before being sure to thank Sahar and Brian and Brendan for the enormous work they put in to making these talks possible. And so bye for now. I'll see you next week.